You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 1995 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the first class in a series given by Brother Ron Eason titled, Studies in the Gospel of John.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. I know a lot of you don't know Alan and myself, but you might find it hard to believe that we find it very nice to be back here. It's only 20 years. But this was my first ever Bible school, and it's still my first ever Bible school. I think it always will be. We found our first two visits here, the warmth and the friendliness and the real fellowship have formed a knot that will never be untied. We're very grateful for the invitation to come back. I don't know about Brother Janaway and his Christian dolphins or Alan and his Christian elephants, but I always thought we were the prototype flower children, the Christian Delphiniums. That's what they used to call me when I first went to sea. They couldn't understand what a Christadelphian was, but Christian Delphiniums came quite readily to mind. So, if I am a flower child, let me know about it, and I'll see what I can do to change it. I liked one word that Alan picked up on, and that was adventure. I'm not here to lecture. I'm not here to tell you what is right and what is wrong. What I want to do is have another adventure. In other words, we want to take a look at the Gospel of John, not as a series of separate studies, but as a single study. We want to ask you to consider a different perspective. Sort of turn around at about 30 or 40 degrees and look at the Gospel of John from a slightly different angle. You're probably familiar with the generally accepted way to break down John, and that's into the eight signs. I have problems with that, not because I think the eight signs didn't happen. Of course they happen, and we'll touch on this later, in a couple of days anyway. But I think John had a vastly different purpose in demonstrating that Jesus preached the gospel through signs. The word for that is used in a gospel for miracles is better translated sign, at least so the experts tell me. Not the ones with halos. But my main concern, really, is as a result of a lot of work I've done in the Gospels in Harmony, is that my firm belief is that there aren't four Gospels at all. There is only one Gospel. You can't sort of say, well, I prefer Luke's definition of something to Matthew's. I prefer the idea that Luke took us away into Perea to preach the Gospel to Gentiles, and the things that happened before the Transfiguration as recorded by Matthew, well, just Matthew's idea. Can't do that. If Matthew says that prior to the Transfiguration that Jesus went up into the horns of Hattim or into some mountain somewhere with huge crowds of people and gave the Sermon on the Mount, then Jesus did it. Matthew said he did it. If Luke takes the Sermon on the Mount and shifts it into the other side of the Jordan River and says that Jesus gave different parts of it in different places, then that's what Jesus did. Luke tells us he did it. And we can't sort of say, well, maybe Matthew was right or Luke was right. They were both right. There is no reason whatsoever to believe that Jesus didn't repeat himself time and time and time again. Where we may have problems is when Jesus is identified in the same location in two Gospels. And he says different things according to these two Gospels. What happened to inspiration? Why didn't they both record what Jesus actually said? Who edited what? These are little problems, and they're very little problems, really, once we get our ideas on inspiration right, at least according to me, which may not be according to you. We appreciate that. Once we get our own understanding, that sounds a lot better, doesn't it? Once we get our own understanding of what we mean by inspired, then we come to a fuller and more acceptable idea of what the Gospels are all about. But we'll touch on that a little later as a small digression. Often enough, as I'm sure you're all aware, Matthew, Mark, and Luke seem to get stacked against John. And after I did my talks on Luke here in 1974, I think it was, sometime way back then, I've always had a love for Luke because it's historical. Does that mean the others aren't? Well, of course it doesn't. But Luke sets out to place Jesus' ministry in history. He says so right at the beginning of his gospel. He sets in order the things that Jesus both began to do and to teach. I think these words approximately are right. You can check them up. So we have to look at Matthew and Mark slightly differently because the sequence that's used in these three gospels is not quite the same. In fact, if you have a harmony of the gospels, you will find that one edition, for example, this one here by Kerr, uses Matthew as his basis. So Mark isn't always in sequence. Robertson uses Mark as his basis, so Matthew tends to get mixed up. But that's simply because he's trying to bring them down in order. John doesn't fit in, apparently. John spends all his time down in Jerusalem. So I'll put this overhead on. Can you all see that? Can you read it? You can't. Well, you just have to come up closer. However, it's up there. I'm going to leave it up there for a while. So once you get fed up listening to me, at least you'll have something to look at. But this gives a rough idea of where Jesus went to during his ministry, the various places he touched on, and just how his gospel breaks down chapter by chapter. And you'll notice, for those of you who can see it, that he spent an inordinately long time in Jerusalem. In fact, if you take chapters 7, 8, 9, and 10, you would get the definite impression that he never left Jerusalem. And then when you work out the actual chronology, chapter 7 is in the Feast of Tabernacles. The end of chapter 10 is at the Feast of Dedication. So what did he do in the 3.5 months in between? Well, you go to Luke, and he tells you. Now, when you think in that light, then you can take John and almost slide him in to the other three Gospels. And I think this was John's main purpose. Because John had Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And he filled in and repeated in certain cases. For example, it's always seemed very strange to me that you get 4 accounts of the feeding of the 5,000, but you only get 3 accounts of the transfiguration. John was there with Jesus at the transfiguration, and he never mentions it in his gospel. Why? I don't know. But the guess I would make is that John decided it had been well enough covered, and there was nothing he could add, so he omitted it. He had other things he wanted to put forward. Whereas, with the feeding of the 5,000, there was one major point, or perhaps 2 major points, that the synoptic gospels missed out. So John points out that the feeding of the 5,000 took place at Passover time. Jesus did not go to Jerusalem for that Passover. At least, as far as we know, he didn't. Another thing that John points out is that After Jesus had fed the 5,000, the people tried to make him king. And he took off, went up into a mountain for communion with his Father. It was a temptation he had overcome in the wilderness. Something else John doesn't mention. He assumes that you know that from your reading of the gospel message in Matthew and Luke. He doesn't need to repeat it. So there is one possibility that John had all three gospels available to him and that he simply filled out the gaps. But I think there's something more important in John's message than that. Let me give you an example. Turn to Mark chapter 1, the first verse of chapter 1. And you notice Mark starts out by saying, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. John starts out, in the beginning was the Word. Perhaps the greatest crisis at the end of the first century, and possibly the free fall of Christianity at that time, was the cause of John writing his gospel at all. At that time, if you think back to your history, the temple had gone. Jerusalem was a ruin. The Jews were scattered into what is known as the diaspora. Jews were forbidden by Roman law from living in the city of Jerusalem, which meant that the historical base of Christianity had vanished, and things started to change. Slowly but surely, the Gentile or Greek Christians started to outnumber the Hebrew Christians, and the emphasis started to move away from a Hebrew base to a Greek base. Well, did that matter? Christianity was Christianity, regardless of the base upon which it rested. But when prominent Christian writers were starting to say, look, we don't need the Hebrew scriptures any longer. We've got the Oracle of Sybil, for example. And then doctrine started to change. The Word became something different to what John regarded it. Those Christians who had been schooled in Greek philosophic concepts looked upon the Logos as the original intelligence by which the world was created. It wasn't a being, it wasn't a person, it was an abstract concept. Until Greek Christians merged the two ideas with the Son of God and the Logos principle, and there was the Son in the beginning. Now, Mark says, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. To the Christians in Antioch, that was pretty straightforward. But by the first century, it had got twisted slightly. The Son of God was God's first creation, the Homo Iousios. In Alexandria, they turned to John chapter 1, and they said, in the beginning was the Word. And the Word was Christ. So the Word was uncreate. Therefore, Christ was uncreate. Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? So here you have two schools at each other's throats. The Alexandrian Jews, or the Alexandrian Christians rather, with the uncreate Christ, Son of God, and the Antiochian Christians in northern, in Syria, with the first creation of God. And they became eventually known as the Arians and the Catholics. And that effectively started a war which was to last for 300 years. And it's rather interesting to note, brothers and sisters, it started over one letter, the Greek iota. And you think about what Jesus said about neither one jot or tittle of the law shall change. That jot is the Greek iota, the letter I, the smallest letter in the Greek alphabet. By taking a composite Greek word, your whole attitude towards your religion was adjusted by either putting in or leaving out that iota. You either came to believe in the Trinity or the Arian doctrine of Jesus as the first creation, subordinate to his Father. Now, we can look back on those ancient times and say, how pathetic, how utterly pathetic. And yet, you look at the Christadelphian body and you see we've done exactly the same things ourselves. The same kind of quibbling over letters, over words, over Greek and Hebrew. And the result has been so very, very unfortunate. Well, the point I'm coming to is that somewhere around the beginning of the second century or end of the first century, in Ephesus, John was the elder, the most respected elder. And there was another John called John the Younger. And he had a pupil called Papias. I'm not pretending to be exact on this because I'm going from memory. And there is a letter from this man called Papias which suggests that John the Elder was approached by the ecclesia at Ephesus to put down in writing his memories of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And what they did, they formed a committee. And John presided over the writing of the letter, the book of John. And the result of this committee's work was the gospel. The words are John's. The writing is not necessarily so. And there are a number of reasons for this. Firstly, it's noted that John is written in a type of Greek that was familiar in Ephesus, not pure Hebrew. Don't quote me on this, as I say, I'm going from memory. But this letter is still around. This letter of Papias is still visible. It can still be read in museums and archaeological bases. So, one little point that comes out of this, we noted from the exhortation yesterday, the mention of the disciple whom Jesus loved. Had it been mentioned once, it would have been glossed over. Had it been mentioned twice, people would have taken a second look. But it's mentioned at least three times. And the suggestion has been made, and I think it's worth your consideration, whether you accept it or not, is that that is not John's wording. John was not the kind of person who would turn around and say, I am the disciple whom Jesus loved. It is the means by which the editor of the Gospel of John identified John in that Gospel. Because he knew that this man, who was the spiritual base of the ecclesia at Ephesus, was indeed the disciple that they knew whom Jesus loved. So, the Gospel of John then, we're suggesting, was written specifically to deal with that first century problem. To take Christians back to their proper roots, which was the Old Testament. And the whole Gospel message in John, which is perhaps above all else the Gospel of salvation, was written to tell both Christian Jews and Christian Greeks in Ephesus that by simply taking Matthew, Mark, and Luke, they weren't being pulled back to the proper roots. They had to take Matthew, Mark, and Luke in light of the Old Testament. Get away from the Sibylline oracles. Never mind your Plato and your Heraclitus and all the others who brought up these philosophies which were so popular at that time. Your roots are in the Old Testament. And the evidence of these roots comes out right through the Gospel of John. So, when we think of the Gospels in harmony, let's just for a few minutes, think of the four Gospels separately. Who did Mark write to? Well, they don't tell us. Mark is the shortest Gospel. It's the simplest Gospel. And the possibility is it was written to be memorized. Here is your statement of faith. It's only 14 chapters. You can read it in an hour. Or an evening if you want to read it slowly and intelligently. But you can read it right through at one sitting. And they couldn't go out and Xerox a copy of it once they'd finish it and pass it on. They couldn't put it on a computer disk. There's no online Bible at that time. In fact, they couldn't even go to a bookstore and buy a copy. They were very, very precious. So the simplest way to have their gospel close at hand was to memorize it. In fact, I can remember years ago, as no doubt Timothy will agree, one of the best pieces of advice, which as most pieces of advice I got at that time I ignored, was to memorize as much scripture as I could. Harry told me that quite a number of times, and I still haven't memorized any of the passages which he suggested I should memorize. But then the idea of memorizing the whole Gospel of Philippians or something just made me shudder. The horrifying thought of trying to memorize two verses was bad enough, but a whole book. Yet, Harry did it. So, that's Mark. Strong possibility is that Mark was written first. It can't be proved, and there are people who will dissent to that view and say, no way, Matthew was written first. But it doesn't really matter. It's what we are comfortable with. But the reason why most people like to look at Mark as being written first is because, with the exception of two or three verses, everything in Mark is either in Matthew or in Luke. And it's Matthew and Luke that add to the basic gospel in Mark. And yet, what Mark actually does is far more detailed than either Matthew and Luke. It's the additions to Matthew and Luke that make it so much longer than Mark. For example, if you compare the temptations of Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Mark is very peremptory. And yet the order of the temptations in Matthew and Luke are different. We wonder why. But it's a fact of the matter that they are definitely in a different sequence. So, we come to Matthew. And it seems to be an analysis of Jesus' teaching, in a Hebrew style of writing, rather than any attempt to give a historic life of Jesus during his gospel ministries. Yet, where would we be without the early chapters of Matthew? One of the longest and steadiest traditions of Christianity is remembering Jesus as a child, according to Matthew's gospel. As we said earlier, Luke presents the historic gospel. He takes Mark's gospel and reshapes it and presents it to us as the gospel for Gentiles. He tries in many ways to take Jesus outside Judea, across the river, into Perea, and repeating the teaching of Matthew later on in the last year of his life, in little bits and pieces. And I have a feeling, I'd have to check on it, that you will find that if you compare the parables in Matthew and Luke, that they're different. They hardly ever repeat the same parable, except with the obvious exception of the parable of the sower. And of course, if you want to study parables, you go straight back to Matthew because you've got them all there in chapter 13. And then another group of a different kind of parable in the last week of Jesus' life. So the Gospels are different. Matthew, Mark, and Luke follow the same basic themes, and John comes in and fills in all the gaps. And it takes a bit of doing, but you can actually fit John into Luke particularly, historically. But there are problems with John's historical ideas. So, in Mark, in John and Genesis 1, we have in the beginning mentioned. And yet, if you look at them closely, they're all different beginnings. The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That takes you back to the time when Jesus first appeared. John could be the same. But John says, in the beginning was the Word. And if we take the Word in its simplest form, he's saying that God was always there. There never was a beginning. Whereas in Genesis chapter 1, in the beginning is the beginning of the 7 days. That's when time started. What happened before that? In the beginning, there's no year we can put to that. There's no time base because, again, God was always there. But we have three different beginnings. And yet they're all in complete agreement. There is no reason for us to have any dissension about what in the beginning means, as long as we take it within the context of each place to which they're mentioned. So why do we get these differences, the little differences that people have thrown at us as being contradictions? Well, personally, I believe that the current doctrine of inspiration is a very convenient crutch for people who don't want to do their homework. They say, well, we know these are the right words because they're written here. Because these people were merely scribes who wrote down what the Spirit of God told them to write down. In English? Or in Greek? Or in Hebrew? And how clearly does the Greek, and of course the NIV is supposed to be in far more modern, up-to-date English, and yet as Alan pointed out from Philippians chapter 2, the editors obviously had a gross misunderstanding of what that chapter's about. And you go back into the interlinear English and you find that it fits the King James Version far more accurately than the NIV does. So what have we got the NIV for? It's simpler to read. But when you read it, please, brethren and sisters, bear in mind that the people who translated the NIV have very, very strong ideas about what these messages are supposed to be saying. And it can be very confusing, especially these days, when you've got so many different translations. And as has been suggested by many people, perhaps the King James is still the best we've got. And many brethren and sisters have bought the New King James because while it puts the scriptures into a far more up-to-date English, not necessarily a better English, but a more up-to-date English. They keep it because the wording is, or grammatically, the same. Maybe that's not the right word, but it keeps the ideas of the old King James in rather more up-to-date English. So I might suggest that inspiration is inspiration of the man and not the grammar. These men were inspired to write the gospel messages, and not just Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, of course, but all the people who have given us our Bible. It's the men that were inspired and not the words, which means that God could trust these people to put down on paper and ink what he wanted them to put down, intelligently, thoughtfully, and with due regard for the people to whom they were writing. And that possibly explains the differences in various places, such as the Olivet Prophecy. It is my feeling that Matthew looks at the Olivet Prophecy from the inside looking out, and Luke looks at the Olivet Prophecy from the outside looking in. I find that very helpful. So, when John set about putting his gospel together, it's almost inconceivable that a man who was inspired by the Almighty to do this wonderful task could write in the beginning, in verse 1 of his gospel, as a contradiction to in the beginning, or the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ in Mark, or in the beginning in Genesis chapter 1. It could again, of course, simply be my understanding of what in the beginning means in English. It may simply be as simple as at the start, or to begin with, or as we used to read in our children's stories, once upon a time, an idiomatic expression and not to be taken terribly literally. And those of you who have studied John knows that in the beginning occurs many times in the Gospel of John, and it really makes you think twice about what that first verse is all about when you study all the in the beginnings in John chapter 1. I was going to leave that to Alan, actually, because I thought that's what he was dealing with. But he's not going to, so these are just a few comments by way of consideration. There is one area in which we want to use up the rest of our time, which I spent some time on quite a long time ago, and which could be considered controversial if you were looking for controversy. That's the cleansing of the temple. And there's one brother back in Victoria, BC, to whom I'm very grateful for that. We spent a lot of time, and actually it was Wendy's brother Gordon who put me in the right direction there. We got talking about whether there was one cleansing of the temple or two cleansing of the temple, whether it was at the start of Jesus' ministry or at the end of Jesus' ministry. And Gordon and I both came to the conclusion that there was only one cleansing of the temple, and it took place in the last week of Jesus' life. So the question then we come to is, why do we get a cleansing of the temple in John chapter 2 if it took place at the end of Jesus' life? Well, this is one of these adventures. I'm going to put forward a little of the evidence that we put together, present it to you, and let you make up your own minds. I'm going to suggest later on this week that there was a far better reason for it than I'm going to put forward now. All I want to do is present you with some of the evidence. And that is, firstly, that John makes no attempt to write a chronological gospel. As we will demonstrate on Wednesday, John is like a jigsaw puzzle, and there must be many of these books in the Library of Congress, which Alan mentioned this morning, which have spent pages and pages and pages trying to solve the problem of John's chronology. The fact, for example, in John chapter 8, as one very obvious example, we have the woman taken in adultery. It's set right in the middle of a sequence of chapters during the Feast of Tabernacles, 6 months before Jesus died. There's an absolutely wonderful lesson to be learned from it. But if you notice in your more modern versions, it will tell you in a footnote that it doesn't belong there. And all sorts of manuscripts have John chapter 8, 1 to 12 in different places. 1 to 11, rather, in different places. Some manuscripts take it out completely and stick it on at the end of the Gospel of John as a sort of nota bene. But everybody is agreed that it happened. This discussion between Jesus and the woman is historical. But whereabout in the Gospel of John it should belong, nobody knows. There's no means whatsoever to identify precisely where this took place. And it's the same with many other chapters. We'll touch on that again. The cleansing of the temple comes in John chapter 2, verse 13. And the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem and found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money and overthrew the tables, and said unto them that sold doves, take these things hence, make not my Father's house an house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it was written, the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. That last verse is an addition by the editor of the book. It obviously was written at a later date. After Jesus rose from the dead, this was remembered, the zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. And John is absolutely full of that kind of comment. In fact, sometimes it's very hard to determine whether the words of John are editing or actually Jesus' words. Go through John 3 sometime and see if you can work out just where Jesus' words end and the editing starts. You'll be very, very surprised how hard it is, because suddenly you find yourself in an area where it's obviously after the event. It's a reflection back in what has been said, and then you've got to backtrack and say, well, where did this editing start? As Harry would say, there's some homework for you. You can take these verses in John chapter 2, verses 13 to 22, and fit them in very easily into Matthew 21. We're not going to do that, I'm just mentioning it to you. It can be done, because Matthew and John fit together beautifully in that context. You could, at the same time, take these verses and go to John 12, verse 19, and you could fit the cleansing in there, without losing anything from John chapter 2 at all. Take it in its historical sequence, and you wouldn't have any problem, because then it would be precisely parallel with the other three. And doesn't it seem strange to you that when you have three full accounts of the cleansing of the temple in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, that none of them even suggests that it was the second time the temple had been cleansed? that John never even hints in John chapter 2 that Jesus was going to do it again. And that during Jesus' trial, in Mark 14:57, the witnesses say, "We heard him say." And then they don't quote from Mark. They quote from John. The words they use at the cleansing of the temple, which Mark has accounted for, they ignore. And they go back and quote the words from John chapter 2. 3 years before. Two witnesses, more or less taken off the streets, and they ignore the cleansing that had happened within a week, and their memory takes them back 3 years. I wouldn't think that they would be particularly reliable witnesses, which of course they weren't. But perhaps the main point comes in John chapter 4. And if you note some of the pointers we've got here in this last section here, you'll find these are all verses that show Jesus' tendency, not just for the first few weeks of his ministry, but for the first 3 years of it. No confrontation. None at all. John chapter 4. "When therefore the Lord," verse 1, "knew how the Pharisees had heard that Jesus made and baptized more disciples than John, he left Judea and departed again into Galilee." He had not reached a point in his life where he was prepared to come to serious discussion or argument with the authorities. The Pharisees knew, and they would therefore send a delegation from Jerusalem to Jesus, and why are you baptizing? Confrontation right away. Jesus wasn't interested in that. So why would he be prepared to confront the authorities in the temple? Since time after time in the Gospel of John, he avoids this kind of thing. Think of the wedding at Cana. And he said to his mother, "My time is not yet come. This is not my hour. I'm not prepared to be put forward as a possible Messiah at this time, just by changing water into wine." It was done quietly, inauspiciously. So John chapter 2 tends to be out of context. The authorities in Jerusalem had no idea who he was. They'd never seen him in Jerusalem up till that time. If they remembered a 12-year-old boy, then possibly they might recognize him as the same person, but it's unlikely. But we feel, brethren and sisters, that there is a far deeper and more impelling reason for ignoring the chronological sequences in John. He has a lesson to teach us. And that he'll have to wait till tomorrow.